FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz, and today is 9/17/19. Well, if you've been reading the papers, watching Zero Hedge, it's actually not that well reported. A couple of bits in the Wall Street Journal, you might come to understand there is a market meltdown taking place that the Fed is trying to avoid. We're talking about the repo market, and our good friend Danielle Park will explain what a repo is, since I'm not that clear on it myself, but I know that there's trillions of them out there and money is flowing around the globe in these repos. If you've got an opinion about the repo meltdown, email us kl@kerrylutz.com and make sure you take a look at Danielle's site, jugglingdynamite.com. So Danielle, welcome. And what is a repo, repurchase agreement? It's not something you do in your normal daily life.
No, it's a short-term borrowing thing that dealers typically do with the government, or the central bank. So a dealer will sell a security, and then on an overnight basis, typically, and the next day, the agreement is we'll advance this to you overnight, and the next day we'll buy it back. So it's always meant as a short-term, just a way to increase cash or reduce cash on an overnight basis. And it's part of the sort of daily mechanisms that go on in this complex web of financial transactions that move through the world like the fluid or the water that keeps the system moving. And when you have a sudden move in rates, which is sort of way out of the realm, it can be quite a shock, and it can cause a liquidity crunch. And that's exactly what happened overnight. So the rate on one of these repo agreements went as high as 10%. And you consider that the overnight bank lending rate right now in the U.S. so far, until the Fed's announcement tomorrow at least, is, you know, in the 2.25 range. So to have something spike to 10% is a big dislocation in a system that's meant to be, you know, calm and predictable. These are not supposed to be the volatile rate section of the market. And so it can cause a great sort of knee-jerk reaction. And we saw that sort of response in the start of the 2007-08 crisis.
Correct.
When you had, you know, essentially a freezing where people, they're doing sort of going through the motions of these repos, which are part of their everyday function. And then all of a sudden you get a rate quote that's 10% versus, you know, 2%. Mm-hmm. And it literally seizes up the system. So today, the New York Fed announced that they injected just over $33 billion into the overnight system, so the banking mm-hmm. system, and that's meant to sort of calm things.
Right.
But we'll see. And so far, you know, it has. But this all really brings more focus to bear. I say, you know, if you're not comatose, only the comatose aren't aware that there's been a whole bunch of unhingings going on in the financial system, pistons blowing, as it were, over the past couple of years. You know, the oil spike yesterday was another big shock. And what the problem is that when you've got a very complacent, largely passive allocation to many of these assets at peak valuations, 10 years into a credit expansion cycle, when cash levels are low and leverage is extremely high, any kind of sudden and dramatic price change can really topple the apple cart, so to speak, and cause a great deal of strain and liquidation ultimately. And the liquidation selling, of course, as you know, is what ultimately triggers these panic waves in markets, which ultimately become sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And that's happened for, you know, centuries. So it's just a question of which one of these is going to be the final trigger point, because we've got policy stretched to the limit. Central banks have assured and really run out of their currency that they typically work with. The U.S. Fed has the most rate room to cut of anyone in the world in the major central banks, but it still doesn't have much. So I think, you know, It's just this, like, everyone's strung out on caffeine and crack right now. And the slightest unpredictable move can create a lot more strain than you might think in an otherwise less levered and less overvalued situation.
Exactly. Couldn't agree with you more on it. And there's also a thing called a reverse repo agreement. So that's where you agree to sell it before you own it. I don't quite get these things. I mean, that's what they're, it's part of financial alchemy. The one thing about repo agreements, they've been around for like 50, 60 years. They're not new, but I think the quantity of them and the ability to hypothecate them, hyper-hypothecation technology has created a veritable financial Frankenstein here that is just waiting to descend upon its creators.
Well, again, it's a function of leverage and the speed at which moves happen when you have more leverage, right? So it's like, just as one example, the amount of levered loans in the system have increased almost doubled, actually, between 2008 and 2019. So you just have levered loans, again, being money borrowed to borrow money, you know, leverage on leverage on leverage. And so that just means that, again, people have very little cushion or ability to absorb any sudden shock or adverse move in price. And, you know, one of the big problems right now, of course, has been as the U.S. Fed has been hiking rates and quantitative tapering, you know, reducing the amount of funds on reserve at the banks. What's happened is liquidity has been coming out of the system. That was intentional because they were trying to, you know, what they describe as a mid-cycle tightening, but really it was a, holy cow, we've been at emergency rates for a decade. Surely we better try and back towards the door here at some point. So they started doing that with a straight face. And of course, what's happened in the last decade, because rates were so low so long, because there was so much speculation rampant, you had a lot of emerging market players who were borrowing U.S. dollars at low rates and buying things or funding their budget deficits or funding their expenditures in their companies in their, you know, home currencies. So they were, while the U.S. dollar was you know, cheap rates, they were, that all worked great. But once rates start rising, their cash crunch begins, right, in the U.S., because that's where they owe a whole bunch. They have record amounts of U.S. debt right now. So any kind of currency appreciation is very severe, making their debts that much bigger. At the same time, you've got all the trade stuff, which partly is just end of cycle, slowing consumption, you know, credit contraction in the world globally. But then on top of that, you've got all the trade tariff stuff, trade war stuff. So you've got this downturn in the world. Trade, export, shipping, everything going on, which means less cash flow. And because the U.S. tends to be the biggest consumer of emerging market goods, you know, when they're consuming less of those goods, you get less dollars going to those countries. And those are the very same dollars they need to pay their bills, pay their debts. And so you get a lot of imbalances starting to really manifest and magnify again in the financial system, which just has, again, the knockoff effect of having less consumption in the poorer countries as well. And, you know, everyone's kind of running low on funds. So it's interesting, even yesterday with the drone strike and the Saudi production site, which is a pretty significant event, and you did see that big spike in the price of oil. The reality is, though, that we already have a glut of oil in the world because we're in a downturn in the global economy. So even though there was a dramatic one-day move, you know, oil remains well below where it was a year ago, you know, 40, 50% below its peak of the 2008 cycle. Things like copper fell on the day. So that's more like, you know, indicative of the actual demand in the cycle, still saying, well, oil may be having a spike day, but frankly, bond yields continued lower, copper continued lower, all reflecting again the fact that the last thing that a highly indebted, overlevered, overvalued economy late in the 10-year cycle needs is a spike in the price of energy. Yeah. You know, so it just means that's likely to slow things even more. And that's the thing. It's just, it's not one thing that is the tipping point. It's the accumulation of all these things that have gone on so long.
Yeah. Well, I found it interesting about the Saudi strike. You know, I don't know who did it or what. That's not the aspect. But at first, The first reports were it knocked out half of Saudi Arabia's oil capacity, and it would be down for months, if not forever. And now we hear, maybe a week or two. And the other thing that will result from this, of course, which nobody looks at, but I know you do, is that a lot of, when you have equipment in the oil field, it tends to obsolete over time. And so when a refinery has like a major disaster, which they do periodically, explosions, fires, they're actually able to get rid of a lot of old equipment and put in new equipment that's much more efficient. And that, no doubt, is what's going to happen. So the reversed effect is going to happen, that Saudi Arabia's production, perhaps it won't go up, but it will be more efficient, more economical to produce, because they will have state-of-the-art equipment, because they're not going to go buy used equipment for Saudi oil fields. So in effect, it's going to probably have the opposite effect. You wind up getting more supply onto the market in the next 2 to 6 months as all this stuff gets replaced. And,
well,
remember, like, the oil fires that Saddam Hussein had started in Kuwait, they said it was going to take years to get rid of them, to stop them. A matter of 2-3 months, they were gone. So you got to be aware of hysteria in the market. You know, what do they say? There's only two emotions in the market, right, Daniel? Fear and greed. Mm-hmm. And the fear took over yesterday.
Yeah. And there's a lot of oil in storage, Kerry, everywhere in the world. And not only that, but the shale revolution in the U.S., as soon as prices spike, there's more incentive for pumps to start again. Mm-hmm. But overarching themes here, I think it was interesting yesterday. I put it on the blog that the BNP Paribas analyst came out with a new report just pointing out that, as oil was spiking above $60, that's actually a death knell for oil in general, because the reality is that the pace of evolution in the technology of renewables with storage and EVs, which we've been talking about for a long time, that is, of course, happening so much faster than many people thought possible. And when you look at the cost of, bringing, for example, in transportation in particular, it's a massive dislocation of the status quo, because it's more efficient already to invest capital for wind and solar projects along with storage and EVs, a factor of about twice more efficient to bring that kind of power system on the grid than to invest in new oil production. And in fact, the report says that over the next several years, the only way that oil is going to remain competitive as a transportation fuel is if they can have a cost somewhere in the area of $10 a barrel and $17 to $19 for diesel. So even if that's, roughly in the right direction, which these things have been going, as I say, against everyone's, confident assertions it could never happen, it's happening. And what that means is that the higher the price of oil goes, the less economical it is, the faster these other power sources are going to challenge it for market share. So, on the one hand, speculators may say, great, the price spiked, thank goodness, let's ramp up some more production from the current oil wells. On the other hand, it's long-term more destructive of demand and production probability.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree partly, and I disagree partly with that study, because, all the efficiency that takes place in the car, the electric vehicle itself, it's much more efficient, like roughly double or triple an internal combustion engine. But the power grid at this point in time is not really very efficient. You lose like 40% of the power that gets generated. So when you actually look at the efficiency after that, it's not as great as everyone thinks. The power grid really needs a major overhaul, because the technology exists, with these superconductive lines to actually to raise the efficiency to 90%+. It just hasn't been done. But, short of building new power plants, you're going to have to make that grid more efficent, because there's transmission.
But they're working
loss.
On that. They're working on they that for sure. And I agree with you. It's not a simple overnight anything, but these are long-term studies that are looking at current trends, the pace of development, the finances, the cost per unit. And it's just making the point that, you know, all of this, really, what the Saudi oil strike and the fact that drones are going to be a commonplace and have become a fairly commonplace tool of war or terrorist stuff, it really just shows how vulnerable we are when we are dependent, especially upon energy sources from places like Saudi Arabia.
Oh, for sure. For sure. No doubt about that. And, you know, there's just got to take the whole picture into account. But the fact is that to go 1,000 miles on a gasoline car as opposed to going 1,000 miles on an EV, it's far cheaper to do it. Not quite as convenient at this point, but it's far cheaper. I think depending on whether you charge it in your garage or go to a supercharger and they charge you, you know, and there's all sorts of different things. You know, it's probably 20% the cost. I don't know what have you noticed?
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next.
Today's show is brought to you by U.S. Gold Corp. U.S. Gold Corp is a U.S.-focused gold exploration and development company advancing high-potential projects in Wyoming and Nevada. U.S. Gold Corp has consolidated a district on Nevada's productive Cortex Trend and is advancing the Copper King project towards production in Wyoming. Led by a team of prolific company builders and renowned explorers, including Dave Mathewson, who is directly responsible for several major Nevada gold discoveries, U.S. Gold Corp is well-capitalized and has an extremely tight share structure with less than 20 million shares outstanding and trades on the NASDAQ, a major exchange, under the ticker symbol USAU. To learn more, go to usgoldcorp.gold. That's usgoldcorp.gold.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
I've noticed that, first of all, supercharging with my particular vehicle is free. So I don't pay anything when I'm on the road and I have to supercharge. And secondly, when I do it in my garage, overnight, it's about $3.50 to fill it. So I've noticed that my cost from my old SUV, which used to cost about $95 to fill it, that's Canadian dollars, of course.
They're worth a lot less.
Yeah. So maybe, you know, maybe I had twice the range on a full tank in my diesel SUV. So that would be something like an equivalent of, say, $7 to fill my current EV. So $7 worth versus 90. And I've had zero maintenance and my insurance is 25% cheaper. So there's no question that I've saved a ton already. And also don't forget the longevity or lifespan of an EV is upwards of, you know, 500,000 kilometers plus. Like we haven't had them yet blow up. They've been around now for over a decade and they're still, you know, the ones in the Tesla loop, as an example, in California are going well beyond 500,000 miles. So they're built to last. They're built unlike planned obsolescence in the typical fleet, you know, of ICE engines.
Yeah, all these cars, and it doesn't matter what brand you have. The only cars that are really built to last, there's three brands really. Toyota, Honda, and Ford. All the other ones, and we're talking luxury, high-end, everything else, you don't want to keep them past their warranty because you are going to have, like, service issues because everything in the darn things, Danielle, is plastic. Everything. In your engine, there are plastic pieces that go bad that are designed to go bad after the warranty is over.
Well, and all the business models are predicated on the presumption of parts and service, high parts and service traffic in business and getting you in for your regular, you know, maintenance visits. And that's really the whole dealer model those brands. So think about, you know, the electric vehicles, they have 90% less parts. So they don't have a platform that depends upon service. And that's partly why the vehicles are still more expensive right now, but the cost is coming down a lot. And again, you know, this is a fight that the ICE engines are losing because the math is so compelling that there's no question. You don't have to believe in climate. You don't have to believe in any of that. You just have to look at the numbers and go, boy, I'm going to save a fortune driving this versus the other. And that's why it's going to win.
Yeah. I wonder what our electric rates would be, Danielle, if we had an efficient grid system. They'd be like half of what they are now. close to it because half of it's wasted. It's kind of amazing. You think that electricity is so much more efficient, and it is. Certainly motors are more efficient than engines. It's not even worth discussing. But, you know, we're still using the same transmission system that Tesla created, you know, 130 or 40 years ago. And really, it just seems like if we could get that efficiency up, it would require much less power plant replacement, new power plants, or maybe it would require more, but the pressure, the stress on the grid from all these EVs coming on, that is real. Right now, we don't have enough. There's not enough to make a difference, but if there was, say, 10% EVs out there, we'd be having brownouts and blackouts, especially in states like New York.
Every week, a new wind farm, a new massive installation of some kind of alternative fuel is tying into the grid. So that part of the story is still evolving for sure, but it's evolving at quite a significant pace. There's countries all over the world which are announcing, they're racing to beat each other. Oh, I've just rolled out Scotland just rolled out the largest offshore wind farm. Oh no, North America has now got a bunch of them on the slate. So it's constantly happening, and there's new fuel types being discovered at all the time. So all I'm saying is, like, to try and deny that this is happening is a fool's errand, in my view. Life is full of evolution. This is the natural course. And the more that we are at risk in places like the Middle East, the more that, people are aware of that, the more they're going to see incentive to make these adjustments here.
Yep. Well, kind of inevitable. So going back to our precariously perched financial system, this is just going to add more stress to it, isn't it?
Well, the spike in oil and the dislocation that can happen there, it's good and bad, right? So there's the more efficient, the more cost savings, the less the consumer has to spend, the more they can save, the more they can use to pay down debt. That's all positive. At the same time, to the extent that the economy is dependent upon some of these economies or technologies that are now in receding, that's going to be difficult for things like GDP. It's going to take a while for the new to take over the weight, so to speak, or the torque of the old in carrying the economy. But the new jobs, for example, that are being created in some of these alternative energy spaces are really significant. And that's where we need to look, because we're going to be losing jobs in many of these other areas. Again, retraining is important. Investing in that retraining is critical. So we're at a very significant, secular and cyclical tipping point in the world economy. And many, it's interesting. I've been recently reading a book, The Lords of Finance, which was actually written in 2009, but it is the history of the Western world since the early 1900s, when central banks were originally set up. They were set up and taken down a few times. It's the evolution of the Industrial Revolution and all that stuff. Pardon? Yes.
I say we actually talk about that stuff on the show, about central banking rise, fall, and rise again. So
it's definitely something that's had an ebb and flow. And what you really realize is, the world history and how there's this transition from, there was from buggies to cars, there was from steam to fossil fuel based powers, all this stuff. And then the trying to keep world currencies in balance so that trade is supported rather than quelched. Differentials and interest rates, this is all part of the puzzle. It's interesting, coming into the late 20s, when the crash of 29 happened, the central bank rate in the United States was about 4% at that point. So not that much higher than it is today. They didn't have an enormous amount of cutting room then either. And yet, different policies were tried to re-stimulate, but ultimately there was a transition in the economy at that time as well. And it can be very messy and difficult, and no one's trying to say it's always fun, but it's essential. So again, we need to embrace and think ahead. And what I find is that I wrote about that on the blog this week too, is that, you know, bear markets are necessary and inevitable. They're part of the business cycle transition. And if your plan is just hope they don't happen, it's a terrible plan.
Yeah. Hey, that was a great article, by the way, because classical economic thought philosophy is that we go through these expansionary periods where there's excess speculation. Certainly we have that now. And then we have these recessions, bear markets, to wring out the excess speculation and bring things back to normal. And then the process repeats. And maybe the speculative cycle, bears and bulls, is even more instructive than the economic cycle, because, well, obviously they're related. Maybe one's a reflection of the other. I'm not sure. But the fact is that a recession, we don't like to think of it this way, and all of our policymakers are always trying to fight them off at all possible costs. But the fact is that this excessive speculation needs to be blown off. If you don't do it, like what happened in 08 and 09, then you get more speculation on top of that. And then you really have problems.
And it's not just speculation. It's also a mal business investment in poorly run companies, which are kept alive by cheap credit in the expansionary phase, need to be cleaned out and curtailed. It's like a big pruning exercise, right? Yeah. To take the dead weight out and to restore some opportunity for people with sober, you know, calculations and investment parameters to say, okay, I see value there now. And it's also in many ways the cost of antiquated systems where, you know, the status quo is trying to keep a certain focus and incentives wise in the economy and the tax system in a certain way, and it runs its course. And in order to have the political will or the oomph to transition, sometimes you need a big dislocation event, and that gives people the reason to say, okay, well, that's broken now, so let's try this. And so I think that's why it's such an important part of the rebirth system to re-energize ideas and aptitude and interest in trying new things or incenting new behaviors.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely going to be interesting ahead. You know, if you look back to the late 1800s, early 1900s, we had a major energy transition from literally horsepower to mechanical horsepower. And, you know, there was definitely dislocations, you know, the old classic, the buggy whip maker, the buggy makers, all of them fell to naught. And then the auto industry grew up rapidly and all the other things that took place at the same time. So maybe we're at that inflection point again. It's going to be interesting to see. Well, anyway, that's it for now. So hey, take a look at Danielle's site, jugglingdynamite.com. Read that article about bull and bear markets. I think it's really timely and very instructive. As you say, bear markets are necessary and inevitable. Use them wisely. And most people don't think of it in those terms, Danielle. Hey, check out our website, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Email me, kl@carrylutz.com. Twitter feed @CarrieLutz, Facebook page, Financial Survival Network. Danielle, we'll catch up with you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, Carrie.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to FinancialSurvivalNetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.